trail and ultra runners, what is going on? What's happening? Welcome to another episode of the Coopcast. As always, I am your humble host, Coach Jason Coop. And this episode of the podcast attempts to shed some light on the oft-debated and misunderstood aspect of the hydration requirements specifically for female athletes. Let's face it, there's a dearth of research on female athletes, and when you combine that with the different practices and philosophies out there that at times prescribe different training programs and even different nutrition strategies for females, either as a byproduct of their sex or in conjunction with the fluctuations in their menstrual cycle, the landscape can get quite confusing. So to help us understand the hydration side of this a little bit better, welcome to the podcast, Nydia Rodriguez Sanchez, PhD, who is coming to us from Scotland via way of Mexico. Nydia just wrote a fantastic review paper titled Fluid and Electrolyte Balance Considerations for Female Athletes, and a link to that will be in the show notes. During the course of this podcast, we go over it all. We go over why females might have different hydration requirements, what are the mechanisms that could cause their hydration requirements to be different, and ultimately try to answer the question that makes the most impact: do females have specific hydration requirements that we as practitioners need to take into account? All right, with that out of the way, I am getting right out of the way. Here's my conversation with Nydia Rodriguez Sanchez, all about the hydration requirements for female athletes. I appreciate you coming on the podcast today. I'm always really excited to bring up these topics about females, and particularly with female researchers, because I believe that's the right way to do it. Sometimes I feel like, with all due respect to the dudes that do this research, it just feels weird talking amongst a bunch of men about potential differences in female physiology. So I always appreciate it when we can bring in our female researchers to talk about these subjects. But before we get into it too much, we were talking off air about some of your athletic endeavors. Why don't you just run the listeners through like who you are, you know, as a person, and then also some of the research that you're involved in?
Hi, Jason. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be today in the podcast. So, well, first of all, I'm originally from Mexico, and well, where I was many years in Mexico City. And that's where, well, from the professional point of view, I am a clinical dietitian. So I studied nutrition for years, and then, well, was very into having practicals or practices in the hospital. And then I decided, like, well, this is not quite right for me. So I kind of look into more the nutrition side, applied for sports. And just, I just love how, yeah, like having an adequate nutrition strategy can help athletes and meaning athletes, and not specifically elite athletes or professional athletes, any level, no? Like, well, having an adequate nutrition, an adequate dietary strategy can really change the outcomes. And just even just the fact of enjoying the sport, enjoying the activity that we're practicing. So I love that of sports nutrition. And then, well, I worked for a while for the Gatorade Sports Science Institute in Mexico, and where I had the opportunity to work with different athletes, with football players. I had the opportunity to work with the National Performance Center, where we had hundreds of athletes from throwers, team sports, a very wide range. And, well, I did the IOC Diploma in Sports Nutrition. That, well, it was an online program. I did it in 2008, 2009. And I remember thinking, it's an online program. It will be an easy one. I think I'll manage. And it was not.
No, it's not. I know a lot of my colleagues who went through that kind of around the same time, and they had the exact same thing. They all came. I remember them coming into the office every day with just like wide eyes, just like, I can't believe I'm trying to absorb all of this information.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, well, also the language, of course, was another challenge, shall we say, no? And, well, having that with a full-time job, well, working for different companies, supplement companies. I work also for a football team in Mexico City. And, well, then I just started trying to grow or to develop further. And, well, I found out about the possibility of doing the master's conversion from the IOC diploma. And, well, there was a possibility to come to Stirling in Scotland to do a 6 months master's conversion. And, yeah, of course, those six months converted into 10 years that I have been in Scotland now. Because I was just enjoying my time in Scotland. I ended doing a PhD that was on hydration, basically. Hydration, and we're looking at the impact on body composition estimations. And also I contributed to the development of the beverage hydration index. That was a multi-center study that we worked with Loughborough University, Bangor University, and Stirling, with Professor Ron Mon as the lead of the project. I had also the opportunity to do a postdoc period, and I was also working on hydration. And then I have been a lecturer for 5 years now on physiology and nutrition. And parallel to this, I also love running, which is interesting enough. All my life, since I was a teenager, I started practicing sport, and I was a gym goer, and I also was a spinning instructor when I was at uni. Nice. I remember I would cover the 6 to 8 a.m. classes and then go to uni, quick shower and go to uni.
Nice.
I remember seeing the people that were running, and I was like, I don't understand why they run now. No one is chasing them now. So I kind of didn't get it at the time. And then, just because of my job, I needed to go to cover a race. And it was just basically to be there in a race, in a pickup number, the numbers pickup of a 10K race in Mexico. And the organizer of the race, he told me, are you running the race? And I was internally no, I don't really run. No, I had seen that it was sold out. I was shame, I could run it, but I noticed it. There is not any number available. And he was if you want to run it, I'll get you one of those. And that's how I ended running my first 10K, that I was quite happy with it because I did it well. I did 52 minutes in the 10K.
Nice. There
and
you
I
go.
Just, I was, this is nice. And I just love it. And that's, when I got the running bug, and my aim was to run a half marathon, then a full marathon. And I just got into it. And just last September, I ran my 10th marathon.
Wow, 10th marathon. Berlin. Congratulations. That's cool.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And, I also feel like for being able to work with athletes and with runners particularly, I couldn't be recommending anything if I haven't experienced that myself. Not I know how it feels getting the horrible cramp and even being a dietitian, once I experienced, I think, what was close to be the wall, and it's I really understand how that might feel. And of course, I need to work on that, no? So definitely I think it's important to experience that, to be part of that, to be able to understand the needs and to feel what the athlete might feel, no?
I appreciate that background. It's not indifferent from a lot of the people that I interview where they have a personal interest in the sport that they're also studying. I also appreciate people who come from a broad sports background and then eventually kind of tailor into their area of expertise. And for you, it seems kind of, and this is going to be the subject of what we talk about today, it seems like a lot of those roads have started to narrow down into the lane of hydration and fluid balance, which is kind of the subject of the discussion. So this you kind of came on my radar with a recent review paper that you wrote, which is the title of which is Fluid and Electrolyte Balance Considerations for Female Athletes. I picked it up, and you have to forgive me. I'm forgetting temporarily if it's open access or not, but I was able to easily find a copy. Is it an open access paper?
Yes, it is.
Okay, perfect. So I'll leave a link in the show notes so that people can go and read this. It's a great read. It's well illustrated. I think people who even have just a cursory exposure to scientific literature will be able to kind of pick up on some of the main points. But I want to peel back your thought process on writing this paper, because whenever you do a review article, it's a very deliberate decision, right? You don't, when you have experimental data, you have to turn that experimental data into a paper. But when you do a review article and you're taking in kind of more of a consensus of the literature with you and your co-authors, there has to be some sort of catalyst for that. And I'm always curious, what was the catalyst for that? And what ultimately were you trying to kind of tease out with this review article?
Yeah, so I think the main reason for this article in particular, and it's a collection of articles. So I think, there is a number there that probably just 30% of the sports and exercise science or sports nutrition related studies include females, which is shocking, I think, no? It's how the women are generally underrepresented, no? And I think that was what triggered the preparation or the planning of this special number of the journal, So the European Journal of Sport Science, they decided to create this issue. So it's a special issue where this review is part of. There's a collection of papers, of reviews. So there is one on carbohydrate, there is another one on protein. And well, this special issue that is specifically targeting nutrition for the female athlete was, the editors were Professor Kirsty Elliott-Sale, who is in Manchester Metropolitan University, Dr. Jose Areta, that he's in Liverpool, John Muir's.
Jose is a former podcast guest as well.
Ah, excellent. Yeah. So yeah, he's a good colleague. So they actually were the ones with the original idea who decided to put this together. So I think they look into, who is doing research on these topics. And, they organized that special number. So it's the issue number 5, I think. It's all the topics around nutrition for female athletes. And I love that issue. Not because I'm part of the authors, but because I think it's very relevant, like the part of the carbohydrate that they actually delve into. Do we need a special recommendations for the female athlete? And, the same for protein. And it is a very nice a collection of reviews. They got in touch with Professor Stuart Galloway, who is, my mentor, and he was my PhD supervisor. And, his expertise in hydration, and also Paola, is the main author of the paper. They did a study where they investigated the impact of the menstrual cycle phase on rehydration. So actually, in that study, I contributed a bit, and I was one of the participants as well. So I had I experienced the trials firsthand. They had a fluid restriction protocol, and then you would need to go under a exercise period, and then they were measuring the different responses on post hydration impact, or how the menstrual cycle would impact the post hydration responses. That's how we started working on this review.
Well, and there's been definitely an uptick in interest over the past maybe 7 or maybe even 10 years in how we need to look at females differently through the research lens. And it has a lot of different contexts to it, but I can kind of summarize it into basically like 2 buckets. Part of this interest is some of the mechanistic plausibility of how females respond differently to interventions, to metabolism, how their hormone cycles affect different parts of that adaptive response. And then part of it, as you alluded to earlier, there's a dearth of research that's actually conducted on women. So it's kind of led to this really interesting milieu of practice, which we see from coaches and nutritionists, that is mainly based on the mechanistic side of things, in this rapidly emerging science of how women actually respond differently to, we're going to talk about hydration today, but also the overarching umbrella within sports science. So whether it's a strength training intervention or even a heat training intervention and things like that. And before we dive too much into the hydration piece of it, I kind of want to just get your perspective of it, because you've seen that evolve over the course of your academic and practitioner career. And I'm just interested to just hear that perspective of how you've seen that landscape potentially shift over that course of time.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting how things have definitely changed. And if we think in the previous years, and I'm talking probably some decades, when even females, they weren't allowed to take part in a marathon because, the fear that, they were too fragile or that something might happen, no? And I think there are some documentation historically, since I think the Olympic Games in 1928, when the women, they were, banned for their participation in distance events. So that's very scary, no? There were some assumptions about, sex differences that, they might impact their responses or their physiological capacity. And when we think about Catherine Switzer, of course, running in 1967, the Boston Marathon illegally. And you see all these pictures and all these videos of the organizers chasing her because she wasn't allowed to do this. And it wasn't until the early 80s when there were a couple of studies when they demonstrated, actually, there is no difference between the thermoregulation between male and female. So it's not that women are at a disadvantage or that they might be at this risk or at a higher risk of heat illness, no? So I think that's when things started to change. Like, well, yeah, we are different physiologically, but yeah, not that different, no? Like, well, we need to, yeah, take that into consideration, but it's not that it's, I don't know, like we are talking about completely different organisms, no? So yeah, like we need to consider some aspects, but probably I like my opinion as a researcher, as a practitioner is, as with a man or with a male athlete, we would talk about individualized strategies for the carbohydrate, the protein, or well, thinking about the periodization, or depending on yeah where they are at their competitive season, etc. Well, it's the same with females, in my opinion. Like, well, we'll need to work on sweat rate, like the different requirements in that. Well, we'll talk about that later. But yeah, how much sodium they are losing through sweat. Like, well, thinking about the different environment conditions, like for a male or a female, it will be different if they are training in a 20 degrees environment or if they are competing at a 40 degrees environment, no? So all of this will be different regardless if they are a male or female. So I think, yeah, we need to focus on the personalization, but not just like the differences caused by the sex, yeah, like the sex differences.
I think that last point is actually very poignant because I can remember long enough ago to where some of this initial practice that we need to design training and nutrition interventions markedly differently for females as opposed to males. It was kind of the premise of that was kind of based on that two-prong aspect that I mentioned earlier. First, there's a dearth of research around women. And so when you don't have that to draw from, of course, you can draw different conclusions. But the second thing is the kind of the mechanistic plausibility around why we would actually want to design interventions differently around women versus men. And the combination of those two, the mechanistic plausibility with the dearth of research, led to a lot of this practice that, hey, our strength training interventions should be, or maybe our strength training, I'm trying to be very careful because this isn't something that I necessarily ascribe to and I want to kind of tread the waters kind of lightly. Our strength training interventions might need to be different, or our hydration interventions might need to be different, or even the endurance prescription might need to be different. And when you said we're all the same organism, I think that is the bigger category we need to think about, right? We're all humans first. And then we can have these individual differences of one of which, and this is a powerful one, but with all, you know, to be honest with you, one of those differences is sex. So with that as a little bit of a backdrop, we're going to kind of drop into your review paper, which specifically looks at the fluid and the electrolyte considerations for female athletes broadly. And then what we'll try to do is we'll try to tailor it into an endurance audience, which we're going to be kind of the most, which this audience is going to be the most concerned with. So let's start out with a little bit of that dialogue that I mentioned earlier, kind of the mechanistic plausibility. You spend a lot of time in this paper talking about theoretically how hormone cycles can, and I'm using the term theoretically intentionally, theoretically how hormone cycles can actually impact the hydration status. Why don't you walk the listeners through that first, and then we'll get to some of the kind of the finer details of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, the review, as you said, presents how hormonal changes during the menstrual cycle, can affect different aspects of the female athletes. And, in terms of the hormones, the main hormones that we will be considering, of course, there are many other hormones in a woman's body, but those that have been observed that might cause some impact in terms of thermoregulation, in terms of thirst regulation as well, are the estrogen and the progesterone. That, in general terms, they can impact the nutrition needs, the athletic performance, some brain function. In the review, we've focused basically on how the estrogen and the progesterone can influence fluid and electrolyte balance during the menstrual cycle. And something that is important that we need to consider here as well is that, the facts or what we discuss in the review is thinking of normal or the normal or regularly ovulating women, which if we think about that's another big challenge. Now that we normally talk about the 28 days perfect menstrual cycle, which I don't know, you know, amongst my friends, amongst my relatives, I don't think any of them have a that textbook, 28 Days.
And all the women listening to this are thinking the exact same thing. So don't worry. It's not just limited to your friends and family, for sure.
Which is, you know, it's one of the challenges, you know, in terms of research. Like, I understand why just 30% of the studies have included females, because, yeah, of course, it's so difficult to control. And if you wanted to be like really rigorous or very strict with your research methods, well, you would need to be testing the female participants exactly in the same moment, the same day of their menstrual cycle, which if we think methodologically, well, that would take four times or three, yeah, like, well, depending on the intervention that you might have. No, but yeah, that might take, yeah, four times longer than, well, testing a male. No? So I understand that's why. But, well, again, there are some discussions about, well, like how to write or how to describe this perfect menstrual cycle. And, well, it's, yeah, the 28 days long as a normal length. But, yeah, again, in a human or a normal cycle woman, that might take between 21 and 35 days. No? So that's kind of still considered as normal. And, well, in terms of the menstrual cycle, well, we know that there are, we can, like to keep it simple, so there are two big parts of or phases of the cycle. So it's the follicular cycle and the luteal cycle, or the luteal phase. No, sorry, it would be the follicular phase and the luteal phase. Just to make it easier, so whatever happens before the ovulation, that will be the follicular phase. Whatever happens after the ovulation, that will be the luteal phase. So, and well, normally we would start the cycle, or when we start counting the days of the menstrual cycle, is from the menses, or when the bleeding actually happens. So the start of the bleeding or the menstruation, that's day zero. And normally the ovulation in this perfect 28 days cycle, that would be around day 14. And well, in talking about this, well, there are the two hormones that will be, contributing towards the fluid balance, the thermoregulation, and the thirst regulation will be estradiol and progesterone. And in the, like, when the woman is about to start the ovulation, there is an increase of estrogen, and then it is kind of when we have like the biggest peak, and then the estrogen will also increase a little bit in the mid-luteal phase. So those are the two peaks that we might observe during the menstrual cycle. Then in terms of the progesterone, will be like kind of a very low level. Then when the ovulation happens, that's what triggers the increase of progesterone. And it will be at its highest level in the mid-luteal phase again. So during around day 22, day 24 of the menstrual cycle, that's when there is an increase of estrogen and progesterone. And that's when it has been observed that there might be some changes in terms of for example, the body core temperature. There might be a slight increase in temperature in the day 22, 24 of the menstrual cycle. That's the mid-luteal phase. So that's when possibly there is a slight increase of the body core temperature. And also there might be some increase the estrogen has also been observed that when the estrogen increases, that will reduce the osmotic threshold for thirst. So what does that mean? That, well, the osmotic threshold is basically how concentrated, just to keep it easy, how concentrated is our blood plasma or the plasma in our blood. And when the estrogen is increased, that will mean that we will be thirsty when there is like the blood is less concentrated. So that has been an issue that has been discussed, that probably the fact of having greater levels of estrogen that might promote that the females drink more. So for example, that's something that we discussed in the paper, that if females might be at a higher risk of hyponatremia or this hyperhydration, if they drink too much water, that the sodium in our blood gets too diluted, and that might put us at risk of having some important negative effects in our health. But so that's one of the aspects that has been discussed, if the hormone changes in the female physiology and during the menstrual cycle, that might change. That's something that might be different in women.
Okay, so you honed in on two of the aspects that probably get discussed the most within these hormone changes, and that's an increase in core body temperature and changes in the desire to drink. And a lot of women and men who work with female athletes like myself will recognize the first one through the lens of the wearables that are coming out that are trying to predict when the menstrual cycle or what phase of the menstrual cycle a woman is actually in. And a lot of that is just based off the temperature that the device can measure. Not all of it, but a lot of it is actually based on that. So now we come into like the meat and potatoes of this whole discussion, right? We recognize that some of these hormone fluctuations do impact certain pieces of the physiology, right? We can see rises in core temperature and we can predict things based off that core temperature. We can see differences in the drive to drink, and we can definitely observe and measure that. And that's not really that disputed. What we can get into now is, how does that actually impact people on the ground? Should we actually be prescribing things differently based on what part of the menstrual cycle a female is in, or the fact that they are female in general? And this is where we start to disentangle this. Do those physiological differences that we can absolutely measure and recognize, how much weight do they have within the entire picture, especially when we're talking about athletes and there's a whole host of other things going on? And that aspect of looking at the impact of the hormonal fluctuations to reality, to performance, is not indifferent to women. We can always look at mechanisms and how exercise or interventions affect mechanisms, and then compare that to end performance or whatever end goal that you're actually kind of looking at. So I want to try to, like, you know, go, not to get too far ahead of ourselves here or to take any of the nuance out of your paper, but let's kind of go for the jugular and then we can back up and as to why. So when you can summarize all this paper, should women, do they actually have different fluid and electrolyte needs during the course of their menstrual cycle, to the extent that we should be prescribing things differently to them at any one of those points?
My opinion is that, well, we need to keep, well, like the recommendation is always, as for the males, like, well, like, keep the hypohydration or the dehydration levels to, yeah, not anything more than losing 2% of their body mass through sweating. So that would still apply for females, regardless their menstrual cycle. So I think in this case, I don't think there is we don't need to prescribe something different based on their menstrual cycle phase. So yeah, probably, yeah, it's important to understand, well, what menstrual phase they are at, but it won't make any difference. And just recently, there was a review that was published that Professor Stuart Phillips in Canada, he is one of the co-authors, he's a senior author in that paper, where they demonstrated that, well, there is no any difference in terms of exercise performance, regardless the menstrual cycle phase. So I think for hydration recommendations, yeah, we need to stick, yeah, female athlete, they should be drinking enough fluid during the exercise to avoid any significant hypohydration or dehydration. So that means the female athletes, they shouldn't lose any more than 2% of their body mass. And, well, just to avoid any impact on their exercise performance. And also the recommendation, and this is linked to the hyponatremia aspect that I had mentioned before, of course, preventing any body mass gain just to avoid overdrinking. I think that's another thing that happens with female athletes, that sometimes they are so concerned about getting dehydrated that it's easier to fall in the hyperhydration. So, like, well, answering to the question, I don't think there is a need to have recommendations specific to the menstrual cycle. So I think it's more about the conditions, about, yeah, the environmental aspects that where the runner will be training, well, to know if the humidity, to know, yeah, like the temperature that they will be facing. And of course, well, this could be linked to the fueling, not to the adequate fuel strategies. So yeah, that's my recommendation, no, probably avoiding that. And yeah, in terms of what we were talking earlier about the differences in the core temperature. So like, just to make that clear, yeah, the differences that have been observed in the mid-luteal phase, that, yeah, there is an increase in the core temperature, but it is around 0.5 degrees. So, like, well, just to avoid thinking that, well, that's Celsius degrees. So it's not going from 36.5 to 42, no? So it couldn't be something like that extreme. So it's a slight difference that, yeah, it has been documented, but yeah, that wouldn't justify any change in the hydration strategy. So it could be more linked to, yeah, what they are actually doing, the requirements based on the exercise, the intensity, the duration, rather than the menstrual cycle phase.
Okay, led into the next question that I was going to have with the very tail of that answer. So let's consider the situation of the individual. I'll ask you to put your nutritionist hat on, right? You're a practitioner, you work with individual people. You have a single person, and everybody out there can kind of, or all the women that are listening to this out there can relate to this, and they have a really dialed hydration strategy. They know, and we do this with our athletes, they know, I sweat out 500 milliliters per hour when I'm in, 21 degrees Celsius, and then it's 600 milliliters per hour when the temperature goes up. They have it really dialed. Could that potentially change for that single individual across the menstrual cycle to the extent that you would change the prescription of how much they should be hydrating? You mentioned that this 2% rule, which is kind of an end rule. I get that. But on the prescription side of it, in order to prevent that, should that actually be changing on the individual level?
I would say no. I would say, and also this is a recommendation that with the athletes I work with is, we can't have the same sweating rate for all the year round. So it depends on, for example, if it was a training or competing at 21 degrees and, we know that's the sweating rate, that would be pretty much the same in during the luteal phase or the follicular phase. So it wouldn't make any difference.
And I think one of the things that you also mentioned is the magnitude of the change of core temperature. So yes, we recognize the fact that core temperature changes throughout the menstrual cycle, but what gets lost in that discussion is what is the magnitude of change just due to exercise? And typically in almost all of these hormonal discussions and core temperature discussions, and there's a whole host of other things, exercise tends to be the bigger hammer in the room, the hammer that causes the most damage, that has the biggest effect. And that's just because your metabolic output kind of controls everything. And when your metabolic output goes up 3x, 4x, sometimes 10x from resting, that has a cascade of a whole host of effects that drown out the other effects that we're looking at in rest. Is this, in your opinion, is this the same case that we see when we're looking at these core temperature changes that we recognize very readily across the menstrual cycle?
Yes, absolutely. So definitely the exercise would be a way bigger factor that will be changing the core temperature rather than the menstrual cycle phase. So something that we need to consider. It has been observed that, just around 0.5, the temperature 0.5 higher in the luteal phase compared with the early follicular phase. So, it's just minimal, no? And when we think about, that bigger scheme of things, absolutely, it's nothing that we would need to be concerned about.
Okay. So we've teased apart some of the we've been using the term hydration, and I don't want the listeners to kind of come away with that means just water, right? There's an electrolyte component of this as well that I think that we can look at separately, and it's a component of the paper that you mentioned. So can you give a broad overview of how the electrolyte, sodium, potassium, the whole magnesium, the whole host of electrolytes, how those requirements may change based on these hormonal fluctuations?
Yeah, absolutely. In that regard, keeping that in mind, when we talk about hydration, definitely we need to consider, electrolytes, as you mentioned, sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium, they are key to, they are those components in our cell that will be helping to bring the water in the cell and, of course, to keeping us well hydrated. And of course, they facilitate, if we think about the carbohydrate intake, they will be also related to that. And in terms of, there has been observed that in terms of the differences in the sweat electrolyte concentrations, it has been observed that in general, sodium and chloride concentrations, they tend to be slightly lower in women when they are compared to men in the general population. So when we talk about the sodium concentration in males, it's around 45 millimolar per liter. And in terms of women, they are around 40. So it's a slightly lower concentration. And it also has been observed a big factor that has also mud a little bit the waters regarding the research comparing sexes, is that many times these studies, they are not matching the absolute exercise intensity or the body size. That's another factor that is compared or that is considered like sometimes researchers, they just forget about that and they just compare or they just put them to perform the same exercise or, well, there's something that we need to consider. And when in terms of the concentration of these electrolytes, well, we need to consider the exercise intensity. And, well, we go back again to, well, the individual sweat testing should be conducted, to estimate what's required, no? Because we know that the salty sweaters, no? Like those athletes that tend to sweat quite a lot. Yeah. And, well, or those that tend to, to lose a lot of sodium, or those that we always mention that they have some residual in their forehead or in their clothes. And, well, those are losing a lot of sodium. So we go back to the recommendation. Well, it has to be personalized. Yeah, in general, females, we tend to lose a little bit less than them, a little bit less than of sodium and chloride compared to males. But again, it's not that much. No, if we think about these numbers that I shared, like, well, between 40 millimolar for females and 45 for males, again, it's not a massive difference. No, we are not talking 10 versus 100, no? So that's the big difference.
So we just recently started offering sweat sodium testing in our lab here in Colorado Springs. It's a commercial product. Somebody can come in. We use the precision hydration system, but there are other ones out there. To describe it to the listeners a little bit, you basically sit there with these electrodes on your arm, and there's a collector that passively collects sweat that is induced electrically, essentially, and we measure that in a with a desktop system. And it's a very good way, kind of industry standard way of collecting passive sodium sweat concentrations. And you'll notice big individual differences. So you take a huge population of people. You mentioned the millimolar concentrations earlier. I'll do it in milligrams per liter because most people will recognize that as it compares to their sports drink. Sometimes it'll be 200 milligrams of sodium per liter, and sometimes it'll be 1500 or maybe even 2000 milligrams per liter when you look at it across individuals. But we're going to have a lot of female athletes out there now that we use this, and this has been available for a long time. It's not like it's novel to us, that will ask, what phase of my cycle should I get this sweat testing done on? What's the most accurate representation of this? Because if I'm going to tailor the concentration of electrolytes in my beverage to my sweat concentration, I want that sweat concentration to kind of be the most representative or like the most functional. Should that be a consideration? Should they go in one phase or another? Should they go in when they're in their follicular phase or when they're in their luteal phase? Or is it kind of indifferent? Can they just get it and just apply it?
My opinion is just in any phase, because also I think there are many other factors that I think you had Alan McCubbin before. He has done some very nice research about the impact of diet on the electrolyte concentration. So and I have done a couple of pilot studies on that as well. And well, it seems that, for example, what we have in the night before or the day before, that impacts the amount of sodium that will be reported, no, in a sweat test. So in that regard, there are other factors that might have a major contribution towards the result that we are having rather than the menstrual cycle phase. So it wouldn't have a big impact there. It would be indifferent. Probably it would be, if we wanted to replicate the study or were to, many athletes that they like to be tested probably at the start or at the end of their competitive season, or probably once in the summer, once in the winter, if it's that type of comparison, well, probably it would be recommended just to record, just to have that factor as a standardized condition, just to do it in the same phase. But it couldn't make any difference. It couldn't be something like, when the female athlete was tested in their follicular phase was 200 milligrams, and then in the luteal phase was 2000, wouldn't be that difference.
Yeah.
And there are many other factors that will be related or might be affecting the results.
I think what you're saying is while there might be a change in that sweat sodium concentration, it's not large enough to constitute a difference in the actual advice. Because even with our male athletes, when they come back with 673 milligrams of sodium per liter of sweat, we're not saying that you have to take exactly 673 milligrams of sodium for every liter of fluid that you're taking in. We're putting them into a product that's in the same ballpark, right? And we kind of use a t-shirt analogy, small, medium, large type of things. There's all these different things. But I guess my point is the precision is not, it's not very precise in terms of what we're actually doing with that information. And so if the range actually changes by maybe even 10%, it's kind of the same. It's almost the same deal. It's almost the same outcome in terms of what you are actually functionally prescribing the athlete to do at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And also thinking about that when we are, designing a strategy to replace the electrolytes that were lost. Well, it's not that we are going to, as you said, like we won't have even, it might even be difficult. Imagine like, well, you need to drink 613.5 mils of of the sports drink to cover that. And well, as you said, it will never be exactly much. We're trying to approximate it as much as we can, but with that room of variation.
Okay. So we're going to move on to the final piece of it. I feel like we're getting a bunch of nothing burgers. So I've got a challenge question for you at the very end of this podcast once we cover this last topic here. So the last piece I wanted to cover is post-exercise rehydration. And once again, there's been a lot of focus on this, right? Women need a different rehydration prescription depending upon their menstrual cycle, especially as compared to men. And a lot of this can be driven back to their drive to drink, which is recognizably different across the spectrum. Let's go back and refresh the listeners a little bit about why mechanistically that might be the case. Why might women need different hydration requirements across different phases of their menstrual cycle? And then we can back into the prescription from that mechanistic side of things.
Yeah. So it's just, remembering that how estrogen can change the thirst perception. So that, it has been observed that, there is the increase or when estrogen peaks, remembering just before the ovulation. So around the 10 or 12 of the classic menstrual cycle, of the 28 days menstrual cycle. And then also when we have in the middle of the luteal phase, in the mid-luteal, so around day 22, 24. So in this case, it has been observed that estrogen might, reduce the osmolality threshold. So this, also has an impact on the thirst perception. And the vasopressin, vasopressin is one of the hormones that is also related with how we are drinking and our drinking behavior. And also it has been observed that, progesterone also may increase aldosterone production. So these are, some of the hormones that, they are different and they are affecting the kidney function and the absorption of the fluid at the glomerular level. So if we think about our kidneys, but the most important aspect here is that, the menstrual cycle phase, it seems that it doesn't have an impact on the ad libitum rehydration. So if we allow our female athlete to drink that's related to the fact of that decrease of the osmotic threshold or that decrease of the osmotic threshold is like an indicator of when we need to drink or when we don't need to drink. So basically, the estrogen decreases that level it says we need to drink now. And if we compare when the estrogen levels are higher and having that impact on the thirst regulation, it has been observed that actually it doesn't impact the rehydration. It doesn't have an impact on the overall fluid balance or the fluid retention. And interestingly, this has been observed at rest and also during exercise and of course, after exercise.
So once again, it kind of comes back to not a big difference is at play when you get down to the actual functional prescription of how women should rehydrate.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, it doesn't matter what phase of the menstrual cycle, probably we'll need further investigation, but with the evidence that is available at the moment, it hasn't supported enough that we need to have a different rehydration plan.
Okay. So let's back up here. We're going to encapsulate all of the take home messages with this specific paper at the very end. But before we want to get to this, I kind of want to ask you this question just as somebody in the field, because you've seen the progression of this kind of from start to where we are at in the cycle, 50% done or 100% done or whatever. I kind of want to get your perspective on it, because there was a call, you know, several years ago for more studies to be done on specifically on females. And then there's a subsection of that trying to tease out any sort of physiological differences within the menstrual cycle. And way more often than not, and please correct me if I am not encapsulating this correctly, way more often than not, those differences don't tease out to be very much, if any at all. We can tease out some of the very, very specific things, but then when it gets down to a functional, what are we actually prescribing to females? It tends to be, to colloquialize it a little bit, it tends to be a little bit of a nothing burger. And so I'm always caught between this yin and yang of, I want to see more research come out in this area. But every time more research does come out in this area, it tends to not really tease out anything different than what we knew beforehand. So in your estimation, like, where does the research need to go from here, right? Do we need to continue to try to hammer out some of these physiological differences to have meaningful impact on the prescription? Or do we have a robust enough basis, even though there still is a dearth of research? I'm going to say that before I get a lot of hate mail. Do we need to continue to hammer out some of that research in order to find where some of these differences can actually be? And you can take this within hydration or kind of extrapolate it into nutrition in general, since that's your wheelhouse, obviously.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jason. So as you said, it was a challenging question. But yeah, definitely. I think we need to keep investigating, and just to make sure that, well, all of this that we are observing, that, yeah, there might be an impact, but actually for the practical recommendation, well, it doesn't affect, well, like the hydration strategies. It won't make a great deal, no, in terms of, well, how it looks when we are working with athletes. However, for example, I think an area that needs a lot of research is, well, those that are using oral contraception, or those using other contraceptive methods. Because, well, for example, in terms of oral contraception, well, around 25% of the female population use them. So, yeah, we need to look into that and, well, to investigate further. And, well, also, I know that this is, yeah, opening up a kind of worm. So, because, of course, well, if we think about the other methods, well, if we think about the coil or the patches or the transdermal dispositive, all of this, well, has to be studied. So I believe there is a need to keep studying the oral contraceptives all the other hormonal contraception methods. And, well, before we are able to say, well, males and females, well, the same in terms of thermoregulation, in terms of hydration responses. And, well, just thinking, well, how many athletes and how many women in general, no, are using them. Also, another aspect that I think has to be investigated further is working with amenorrheic athletes. That, yeah, unfortunately, there are many athletes that have amenorrhea. So that means that they don't have a normal menstrual cycle, or that they have missed more than three menstrual cycles. Or the oligomenorrheics, those that are having like a bit intermittent menstrual cycles. So they'll need to be investigated. And unfortunately, well, many of the athletes, even if they are having some energy, like relative energy deficiency or something like that, that might have been impacting their menstrual cycle. So I think that's something that has to be investigated. And I think, yeah, definitely, even if we are finding like very little impact or very little effect, it's important to make sure that we know that's the way it is. No? So I think it's important to keep the research around those areas and those topics.
No, I really appreciate that perspective, because it's not, you know, once again, I'm trying to avoid as much hate mail as possible on this one. I don't want to present the fact that I don't want to see this research, because I do want to see it. But really, over the course of the past several years, every time I see it, I can keep coming back to the same conclusion where there's very little that would actually impact what I do on a day-to-day basis. I'm kind of speaking for nutritionists as well, like yourself, would impact what we do on a day-to-day basis. Yes, there are some things, but it's not so overwhelming that we're treating them as different organisms, to use your analogy. Okay, so let's go through one final exercise here. I want to really take this from a practical perspective and use your expertise specifically within hydration, because this is a great point of consternation amongst the ultramarathon crowd. Our events are just complicated. They're long. They go through big temperature ranges. There's the opportunity to screw it up. You know, I can bring up all the statistics on how many people show up hyponatremic at the end of the Western States 100. That's very well studied. And because of all of those factors, hydration and electrolyte balance becomes a big performance determinant that you can absolutely screw up. So let's kind of go from tip to tail. So we've got an ultramarathon athlete. Everybody's listening to this. It's the winter here. We don't want to neglect hydration in the winter. It's at least in the US, it's the winter. If athletes are out there that are thinking, how can I get a fix on this? And you can bifurcate this however you want to, female athletes, male athletes, whatever. How do I get a fix on my fluid and electrolyte needs that I'm going to actually deploy during an ultramarathon race? How would you go about assessing that athlete and then coming up with whatever the prescription is going to be? Are there some general steps that you would take people through?
So I could definitely go into, considering the big diversity in sweating rates and, of course, sodium losses and electrolytes in general. I will always start with the personalized sweat testing. And this would be the estimation of the sweat rate, at least to get an idea of how much sweat has been lost. Yeah. And again, perfect scenario would be in a similar environment of where the competition will be and the race will be. And based on that, start working with the athlete and designing a strategies, because also I work with runners when they are like, I don't want to, for example, with the carbohydrate, I don't like gels. I hate gels. So it's like, okay, so we need to work around and we'll see what you like, what you will be actually able to do. Of course, we can recommend, you need to drink, 1.2 liters per hour. Is that realistic? So it's not, no. So we need to, I think something that I believe is that, it's something that has to be, working together with the athlete and see, and of course, training the body, also training. We always talk about training the gut, not training for the amount of carbohydrate and of course for the sodium capsules, and yet to let the body that physiologically to be able to tolerate different amounts of sodium even drinking. I myself as a marathon drinker, as a marathon runner, not a marathon drinker, the fact of being running and if it's a cup, that's complicated, no? It's just, how do I stop and I run? I stop, drink, and then run, or what do I do? No, so it's always that question. And for example, myself, I'm always panicky about stopping and not being able to start again. No, so I always try to grab the drink and run while I'm drinking. But again, probably I have to lower a little bit the speed. So I think it's something that we need to work with the athlete. And of course, this is the recommendation based on your sweating rate. Yeah, you need, if it was one liter of sweat that was lost per hour, try to work with him or with her, or with them, to work what's the best scenario. The best scenario would be that you are not losing any body mass through sweating. And what's the kind of almost like creating a strategy? What's the least amount of fluid, the least amount of sodium that they'll need to be ingesting to avoiding any negative impact on their race? And based on that, again, it's almost it's really like practicing that during training sessions. That I understand also ultra distance runners that they tend to train quite a lot and have long trainings, of course, probably not as long as their races or close enough, but probably practicing that and based on the requirements that they might have, trying to get as close as possible and of course to get them trained. And I even think, to train their mind, to get them used to, to drink while running. If they are using any sodium capsule, that those might cause also some GI stress. So also, you need to work with that and to practice that and hopefully for the race day to be as ready as possible. No, and it's something like one of the gold rules. No? Never start using or doing something on the race day. No, so always practice beforehand. And just as you are training your body for that big race, also, yeah, like training for the distance, also well train your stomach, well, of course, your GI system, and of course, train your mind for that as well.
You know, it's funny you mentioned this. Don't ever try anything new on race day. I don't think a lot of people appreciate the detail of that statement because they simplify it to, I don't want to try a new pair of shoes on race day or a new pair of socks or maybe even a new nutrition product. But what it also expands to is the rate and the amount of things that you are taking in during race day. So you mentioned that you can do these personalized sweat sodium concentrations and also personalized sweat rates that you can figure out across a host, or at least the sweat rates you're figuring out across a host of different temperatures, and figure out how much fluid I need to replace based off of that. Well, you can deploy that during the race, 1.2 liters per hour, as you mentioned, or whatever. But if you're not deploying it during training, I'm going to consume 1.2 liters of fluid per hour during the race. If you're not doing that during training, technically you're doing something different during the race. You're consuming 500 milliliters per hour during training, and you're over doubling that during the race. When you present it in that context, and people do this with carbohydrate intake all the time, I'm going to take in 40 grams of carbohydrate during a 3-hour run, right? So whatever math that works out to, 12.5 grams per hour. But then during the race, I'm going to take in 50 or 60 grams per hour, right? You're like 3 or 4X-ing it or whatever. That difference in rate, the ingestion rate, is something new on race day. Make no mistake, that is something new on race day, and the same rules should apply to that. So I appreciate your final sentiment of don't do anything new on race day. And within the context of hydration, part of that is yes, products and the amount of sodium that's in them and the amount of carbohydrate that's in them, things like that. But also is the rate of ingestion that you're taking in. That should not be novel. That should not be new on race day as well. That should be exactly as you had practiced it per the conditions that you should be competing in.
Yes. And also, well, I think this is kind of perfect world, like ideal scenario, because how many times, like, yeah, like we plan for something and environment
goes
or
out,
yeah, like
goes
yeah,
out the window.
yeah, absolutely. I remember my first marathon was Chicago Marathon, yeah, in 2013. I got lost, and then I didn't start with the block I was meant to start. So that meant that I started like half an hour later. And of course, I had drunk everything, yeah, like, yeah, according to starting 30 minutes earlier. So I had to stop and at the first K to the toilet. No, I was like, yeah, I need. So, and yeah, that wasn't in the plan. And of course, well, it was just because, yeah, I got lost. So yeah, I had my perfect hydration strategy. That of course didn't work. And well, it's funny you see in the, yeah, like the running stats. Yeah, stop. It's like, I promise I didn't stop. No, I had to stop.
Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And exactly. Ultra running, you get punched in the face a lot. Okay, I'm going to leave a link in the show notes to the paper. Brilliant job with it. Like I said, I learned a lot from it. And even if it comes back to, I keep presenting it as a nothing burger. I'm saying that not to like trivialize what you have done. But even if we come back to these things aren't as impactful as the exercise or as we actually think we are, I think that's useful information. So I appreciate the work that you've done with this. Aside from the article and some of the links that I'll leave in the show notes to where you work out in your university, where else can people find more about you and the work that you do?
Well, you can find the University of Stirling website. So yeah, you can find my list of publications there. And yeah, like all the many of them are open access. Most of them on hydration. I also have some work on fish oil supplementation. So yeah, some data there and body composition. That's another area of my research. So
excellent, Nydia. I appreciate you coming on the podcast, and we'll have to bring you back on and talk about fish oil or something like that at some future point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love that.
All right, folks. There you have it. There you go. Much thanks to Nydia for coming on the podcast today and shedding some light on this incredibly interesting topic. And whenever I discuss this with researchers in the field and also practitioners, I always kind of come back to some of the same philosophy or some of the same sentiment. And that is, we can recognize that female athletes are different than male athletes. And we can also recognize that there's a big impact of the menstrual cycle on their training and hydration and nutrition. However, those impacts kind of pale in comparison to the individualization that you should already be using with any of those types of prescription, whether it be strength training or endurance training or nutrition prescription. So for those of you out there that ascribe to some of the philosophies that might change some of these requirements or some of these practices across exercise and nutrition a little bit more dramatically, either due to the fact that your client or you yourself are a female, or you're in different parts of your menstrual cycle, I encourage you to look at the research a little bit more in depth, because as we see it right now, there's really no compelling high quality evidence to fluctuate any of these components any more so than you would do on a normal basis when taking into consideration the normal individual variances with any one particular athlete. But if you happen to disagree with me, my DMs are always open. You guys know that I'm always open to discussion on these things. I'm happy to engage in any sort of dialogue possible. So you can hit me up on any of the social media channels if you want to partake in that particular debate. Much thanks to all the listeners out there. I appreciate the heck out of each and every one of you. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and your training partners. That means a lot to me. I always like it when I go out in the community and I hear people talking about this podcast, or they just thank me for putting the content out there. That is it for today, folks. And as always, we will see you out on the trails.